Hello, and welcome to Sonoran Desert Institute's School of Firearms Technology's official podcast, The Gun Rack. Hello, and welcome to The Gun Rack, Sonoran Desert Institute's School of Firearms Technology's official podcast. I'm Josiah Upper. Folks call me Joey, and good radio etiquette is to say that every single time, even if you've heard it 100 times, so get ready for it as I'm brushing up on best practices here in this little one-man podcasting establishment. But enough about me. Today we're doing something I am very excited about. Hopefully I could get you guys excited about it too. So, as we talked about way back in the first episode of The Gun Rack, and have touched on a couple times since, history is a big passion for me. History is one of the things I studied when I went to college. And for you guys, I have to imagine there's a lot of the same. The gunsmithing industry is one that is very rich in history, and it tends to attract history buffs to it. We also at SDI have an enormous veteran population we have the pleasure of serving and helping to educate. So it seems only fitting to add some firearms history and some military history into the mix. Here's how we're going to do that. Today, this is April 21st, 2020, when you guys should be getting this. We are going to be launching a history episode once a month for you guys, and what that's going to be is we are going to cover a event within American military history. I'm going to try to do something in a chronological order. We'll see if that pans out. There's so much to cover. But the reason we're choosing to launch it right now, as some of you guys know, the anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord actually just passed like 2 days ago. I think it's April 19th. It is April 19th, and I better sure that date up before I start talking history with you guys. But, of course, the Battle of Lexington and Concord sparked the shot heard around the world. You've got the Ride of Paul Revere, which is memorialized by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Dawes, poor William Dawes, just completely gets left out of that one. But all that to say, the timing is right. I think this is something you guys are going to enjoy, so we're going to dive right on in. First off, what we're going to do is dispel a few myths and call out a few players in this one of the biggest moments in American history. So first, of course, we have got the famous and the revolutionary Paul Revere, a silversmith from New England who would take the opportunity this night on April 18th to ride his way into fame and immortality. And unfortunately for William Dawes, we also have William Dawes who did the same thing. He rode out and got residents the news, but to much less applause and fanfare, because sometimes that is how history teaches us. Of course, you've got, with Paul Revere, there's a much more romantic aspect to it, which we will be diving into here shortly. You've got the one if by land, two if by sea. William Dawes is decidedly less exciting. But to back up, we've got a couple of things to discuss. Of course, leading up to the Revolutionary War, there is a series of acts, ACTS, created by British Parliament, specifically dedicated to bringing the colonies in line. And of course, you have the Sons of Liberty and other patriotic firebrands throughout the country, but especially in New England, stirring up the discontent. Those Sons of Liberty did not want to be taxed without representation, which is to say they did not have any form of representation within British Parliament, and it seemed absurd to them that they were being ruled by a government in which they had no say. which is, of course, foundational to the American Republic that we have today. So that is part one of this. There are a series of acts, most importantly for us, that's going to be the Intolerable Acts, which, among other things, puts New England, Massachusetts in particular, under what is essentially a military occupation. There are lots and lots and lots of bored and miserable British regulars all throughout Massachusetts at this point. They had the, not too long before this, we of course have the Boston Massacre. The Boston Massacre took place when a bunch of patriotic rioters started to pick a fight with a man who had just struck another patriotic rioter who had said some talked some smack with the about the regulars commanding officer, excuse me. So we have lots and lots of political movement. We have lots and lots of very low-scale violence leading up to what is about to happen. Unfortunately, given the enormity of these events, that's probably as deep a dive as I can go into the background. If you want to get in a little further, I'm once again going to recommend Revolutions by Mike Duncan. He is responsible for a great deal of what I know off the top of my head. And the other information I'm going to be coming with today to brief you guys on the battles of Lexington and Concord come from ushistory.org and history.com, which is the History Channel's official website. Between the two, I'm hoping to get you guys a pretty good understanding of what happened and what did not happen during the Battle of Lexington and Concord. Okay, so first thing, we've got two players that are going to set things in motion. First, Britain's general, Gage. General Gage, you got to remember that one. That one will be on the test. Had a plan. His plan was to move during the exceeding unrest quickly and quietly out of Boston with some of his regular soldiers. And he was going to get to Lexington and Concord, where they were hoping to lock down some revolutionary leaders and seize arms and gunpowder. Now, obviously, if you are hoping to emancipate yourself from a nation that is thousands of miles away, and your country or city or colony is just stock full of enemy combatants, you're going to need some gunpowder and you are going to need some leaders. So General Gage gets points for having the right idea of where to go, but unfortunately for him, two things are going to come into play. One, and this is more of a long-term effect, but Gage's aggressive move to try to take powder and subdue some revolutionary leaders is going to take a lot of people who considered themselves good and loyal British citizens, and they're going to turn over to the Patriot side. They're going to become sympathetic to the Patriots. That is something we are going to see happen more than once from different generals, especially a gentleman named Johnny Burgoyne later on. But for now, we're going to go into number two, which is the British soldiers and some within the British command actually were fairly sympathetic towards the Patriots. And within their own ranks, there were information leaks that were going to cost them very, very dearly. As History.com shows, on April 18th, 1775, of course, that is the day before the battles of Lexington and Concord, Joseph Warren, a physician and member of the Sons of Liberty, which we discussed earlier, learned from a source inside the British High Command, oops, those are supposed to be secure, that redcoat troops were going to march that night onto Concord. So, he says, Paul Revere and William Dawes, I'm going to send you out to alert residents of what is going on. Now, there is a very unfortunate bit here where myth has Paul Revere screaming, the British are coming, the British are coming, as loudly as he possibly can. That did not happen. Paul Revere knew wisely that if he sprinted around or rode around on his horse yelling that the British were coming, a bunch of colonials would be confused because they all considered themselves, or many considered themselves, to be good, loyal British subjects. So that wouldn't work so well. Paul Revere and William Dawes went on separate routes in case one of them was to be captured, which, of course, was a wise precaution. But it's also why Paul Revere is going to get the flashier write-up and remembrance later on. So Paul Revere crosses the Charles River by boat to get to Charlestown, not Charleston, South Carolina, Charlestown, where fellow patriots, and this is from history.com still, are waiting for a signal about the movement of British troops. So everybody knew this was coming. They knew some move was coming because Gage was that kind of general. And if you are essentially a military occupier, you need to make sure that the possibility of guerrillas, which wasn't even a term at this point, the possibility of insurgent activity is squashed. So the patriots had been instructed to look at the Boston Old North Church, to look to their steeple, as we all know, to learn which way the attack was going to come from. You might think that the patriots would light one lantern because the British did go on a march from the Boston area to Lexington and Concord, but that is not the case. Two lanterns hanging from the North Church let everyone know that the British were coming from the sea. Now, from the sea is a little strong. Around Boston, there was a very narrow way that they could march out, but it would take much longer. Or they could put their British troops on boats, and then they could sail those boats across a river, and then they could march in much less time as soon as they crossed that river. So that is what they went to do. So in the end, the patriots did end up lighting two lanterns. Of course, at this point in time, the British have total naval, not even superiority, just straight supremacy, which meant that Gage and other British Revolutionary generals were able to pick up their armies and plop them down pretty much anywhere they darn well pleased, as long as it was near the coast, which was most of the colonies at this point. That is a huge advantage they have, and that is an advantage they will take later on during the war. But as we know, the British were marching from Boston to Lexington and Concord. So Revere makes that move, and William Dawes leaves Boston and travels along the Boston Neck Peninsula. This is still looking at history.com. The two of them are able to avoid British capture at this point and meet up in Lexington, which is very close to Concord. If you do not know New England geography, which would be kind of an odd thing to expect someone to know, a lot of these cities are going to be pretty close together. In this case, Lexington is just a few miles east of Concord, which is one of the reasons Gage bound them together into one march. It was essentially a straight shot from Boston, to Concord, with Lexington smack in the middle. So Samuel Adams and John Hancock were holed up in Lexington. That's where they were camping out. And Paul Revere and William Dawes were able to convince them to get the heck out of Dodge while the getting was still good. So they fled. On the road, they were able to snag a third rider by the name of Samuel Prescott, who had already gone all the way to Concord. Presumably, he spoke with Joseph Warren at a later point in time, but that's me hypothesizing, so please don't hold me to that. Later on, Paul Revere is going to get captured by a British patrol, as we hinted at a little bit earlier, and poor William Dawes gets kicked off his horse, who I guess had enough of the midnight ride and had to walk back to Lexington. So that is the prelude to the violence that is about to go down. The American response was fairly impressive, given that this was the middle of the night. At dawn, 77 patriotic militiamen had gathered in the town green of Lexington, where the shot heard around the world was going to get started. Unfortunately for them, however, they were encountered by 700 Redcoats, British regulars, who arrived in Lexington and did not like the sight of the militia there. As History.com reports, a British major yelled, "Throw down your arms, ye villains, ye rebels." Of course, these militiamen are extremely outnumbered. So their militia commander actually ordered them to disperse. So actually, the shot heard round the world almost wasn't. The commander of the militiamen very wisely understood that being outnumbered 10 to 1 by what at that point was one of the best armies on the planet was just, to use a colloquialism, bad news bears. So the militiamen had just been ordered by their commander to break up and had just begun to do so when a shot rang out. That shot is the shot heard around the world. At least as far as I am concerned, technically Ralph Waldo Emerson's shot heard round the world does take place during the Battle of Concord. It takes place around a bridge north of Concord, and Emerson chose that particular moment for a lot of reasons, some of which we'll get into a little bit later, but I would say that the shot fired at Lexington is the shot heard around the world, not because it is as symbolic necessarily as the Concord shot was, but because this was the shot that fired off one of the greatest movements for American liberty ever. And that, of course, is the Battle of Lexington, Concord, and all the good stuff that comes after it. Now, to this point, and I studied American history in college. I have a big military history buff. I have studied this battle a lot. I have no idea who shot the first shot. Nobody else has. They might have an idea, but no one knows for sure who fired the first shot of the American Revolution. But at that point, the British soldiers decided to unleash more than a couple of volleys at the militiamen. As you might imagine, they were considering themselves to be in enemy territory. They were extremely nervous, and not unlike the Boston Massacre, once that first shot was fired, it was game over, essentially. At that point in time, 8 militiamen were cut down. They were dead. 9 more were wounded. And only 1 redcoat was injured. So regardless of who the aggressor was, the victor of the first exchange was very clearly and obviously the British. So at that point, the British moved on into Concord, having lost out on the chance to lock down leaders Adams and Hancock. And they went looking for arms that mostly were not there. There were still some, but with the warning, the Patriots very wisely, instead of choosing to stand and fight in a, if we lose this, we are in serious trouble sort of way, decided to resist in a, we're going to move this out of the way and make your life miserable on the way back home sort of way, which in the long run, of course, turned out to be much, much better. When they went into Concord, they found, of course, a little bit of arms and powder. When they found it, they burnt it. And when they burnt it, as History.com reports, and actually I didn't know this until I looked it up, the fire got out of control. And who knows exactly why that is in the middle of New England, April, where things tend to be very damp. But hundreds of militiamen occupying the high ground outside of Concord, where they had decided to defend themselves, were royally ticked off. They were under the impression that the entire town was going to be burned down, which is, if you put yourself in their shoes, not that unreasonable a thing to be concerned about. So they sprint as quickly as they can to Concord's North Bridge, which was being guarded essentially as a rear exit by a contingent of British soldiers. those British fired on the militiamen. This is, of course, much more, or excuse me, many more. I don't want to get added at later. Many more militiamen than there were in the initial exchange in Lexington. So these British fired first to defend themselves, but ultimately were compelled to fall back when the colonists did not break this time, but returned the volley right back at them. This is the shot heard round the world that Ralph Waldo Emerson is credited by, which is actually kind of a fun fact about this, along with "the British are coming" not being the case. The shot heard round the world by Ralph Waldo Emerson is actually about the bridge, which was not the first shot fired in the American Revolution. Emerson, I presume, was taking advantage of the symbolism of firm American resistance to British authority, even though what was really happening was that the British were being forced back from their own escape route, which is never a great look. So the British prepared to return to Boston. It's an 18-mile march after a few miles. However, at this point, having given the militiamen quite a few hours to put themselves together, 2,000, or nearly 2,000, showed up into the area, and more were coming, which is to say the British regulars were outnumbered something like 3-1. So I need to correct something that I just mentioned earlier. I mentioned that the North Bridge outside of Concord was the escape route for the British. That is incorrect. While they could have used it if they needed to, I am certain, to try to get out, it was actually counterproductive. Concord is a little bit north and pretty much directly east. Pretty much directly west of Boston. The reason that bridge was held was to make sure that the perimeter around Concord was secure, to try to prevent a mass of militiamen descending upon Concord, which, as I just mentioned, is exactly what happened. So, sorry for that, folks. We're going to get back to our feature presentation. All right, so at this point, we have the militiamen growing in number, and I'll give you a spoiler right now. Before the battle ends, the British are going to be facing a militia to the tune of roughly 3,500 men. That is a big force. So the regiment starts to fall back from Concord. The militiamen initially just start to follow them menacingly, as you might imagine, as you've probably seen in news videos at some point or another, to show their disobedience and their armed protest. But armed fighting did eventually break out. Shots were exchanged, and as the British column makes it back to Lexington, which is just, of course, a couple miles away, they encounter a full-on British brigade, which is answering the call for help that had been put out by that regiment. So the British brigade, plus a regiment, is now being essentially pot-shotted at, because these militia fighters are not playing fairly. They're not fighting like regulars. They're hiding behind trees, they're hiding behind rocks, and they're taking shots when they can. And the whole unit is forced to march back as quick as they can while still throwing flanking maneuvers and cannon fire to try to drive Americans at least away from the direct path of the march. But for the 18-mile march back, they are pot-shotted at the whole way. And actually, by nightfall, another group of Minutemen showed up in order to hopefully cut off the Redcoats and finish them off, but their commander ordered them not to do so. This is from History.com. And the British were able to get to Charlestown Neck, where they, of course, had boats, and those boats had guns, which is to say the battle is over. So that is the Battle of Lexington and Concord. There are some lessons to be learned from the Battle of Lexington and Concord. Some are great for the Americans, and some are not great. We're going to go into the not great first. So the colonists at this point in time are not snipers. for 18 miles of marching and the militiamen firing on and off pretty much constantly throughout that time, they were only able to kill or wound 250 redcoats. And that is compared to about 90 killed and wounded on the militiamen side. So that much is good, partially from the fact that they are not all wearing bright red and marching in a single column. The fairly low casualty count on the British side is a testament, however, to how much the militiamen needed to get their heads in the game, as it were. They needed training and they needed practice, and not every militiaman was ready for marksmanship at the combat level. However, and this is the good news, this showed the world that not only were the Americans very, very serious about not being taken advantage of by Great Britain, but that they were able to rout a regiment, essentially, because that regiment was dropping weapons and clothing to move faster before the brigade was encountered, and then kept the whole brigade marching back home instead of dispersing the militia, as I am sure they would like to have done. This is carried on to the Battle of Bunker Hill, which will be the next segment in this series. That takes place on June 17th, 1775, so almost exactly 2 months later. The British do narrowly win that one, but the preposterous fight that the Americans put up in that is a prelude to the resolve of the American people over the course of this, the American Revolution. So I hope you enjoyed that. I've not had as much experience podcasting about history, even though it is one of my very true loves in this world. I know we've done the podcast about Trenton. We've done some speeches from historical figures. We've done the one-take Constitution, which left my voice gone for the rest of the day. That was a good time. But we're hoping to make this a monthly thing, and we'd like to know what you think. So when you hear this, post something on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, if that's what you're into. Tag us in it. Let us know what you think. Please leave us ratings and reviews. Please like and subscribe. All those good things you do for podcasts that are trying to bring you good content, we would love to see. But for now, that is the Gun Rack. I hope you guys are all staying safe during the current crisis. It's great to see that so many people are coming together to make life workable for their communities and their families. So for all of our essential workers, for all of our first responders, to everyone out there who is putting themselves at risk to bring this crisis to an end, we thank you, we appreciate you, and we will see you all at the range. Sonoran Desert Institute is an online school located at 1555 West University Drive in Tempe, Arizona, accredited by the DEAC. For more information, please call 800-336-8939 or visit sbi.edu.